Support for IPR comes from Security Abstract Company, providing trusted, comprehensive abstract and title services to the Johnson County real estate market since 1898, located in downtown Iowa City and at securityabstractcompany.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Friday, March 29th. Coming up later this hour, IPR's Natalie Krebs on the state review of emergency contraception. That's been going on for about a year. Also, Kevin Baskins of the Des Moines Register. I'll talk with him about the layoffs announced at John Deere this week and other layoffs in the state. State climatologist Justin Glisson will be along to talk about muddy rain. Perhaps you experienced that. Also, the early start to allergy season because of our unusual winter. And you'll have to listen to this later in the hour, a short course on Clarkonomics 101. We'll learn about Caitlin Clark's economic impact with UI Professor of Business Analytics Jeff Ullman. Also, a program note, Monday on this program, we'll check in with State House reporters from our neighboring states to find out about the bills and debates among their lawmakers. But first, now, let's talk about changes coming to K-12 education here in Iowa. After months of talk and contentious debate, this week, Governor Reynolds signed a plan into law that will shift funding for the state's area education agencies to local school districts and move oversight of special education to a state agency. Grant Gerlach joins me now, IPR's education reporter. Hi, Grant.
Hey, Ben.
This was a priority for Governor Reynolds going way back to her condition of the state address. What did she ask for then?
Yeah, she really kicked off this discussion in that condition of the state address. And back then, when this whole discussion started, she was asking for more than she ended up getting in this final bill. But there are some echoes of what she was asking for then. What she wanted initially was for all of the funding that currently goes directly to the AEAs, for that to fall under the control of local school districts. And she was imagining a system where the money goes to the districts and they can decide where to spend it. They can spend it with the AEAs for things like special education supports. That's the kind of thing that includes physical therapy, occupational therapy services that are provided by the AEAs for special education. It also includes what the categories we call media and education services, which is everything from lending curriculum to schools to sometimes technology for students with disabilities or training for teachers. Those are all services that the AEAs provide, and she wanted to allow schools to shop outside of the AEA system. They could use a third-party provider. They could partner with other school districts to do it themselves. What ended up happening is something a little different. In this final bill, the system does reach that when it comes to those two buckets I mentioned, the media and education services. After a transition year, school districts will control the funding for those two categories. That's property tax funding that they will be allowed to use with the AEAs if they choose for those services the way they do now, or they could handle it internally, or this bill would allow them to take that money and put it into their general fund and use it for other purposes. It doesn't have to be used for media and education services. So that's where the bill landed on those areas. When it comes to special education, which is by far the majority of the spending that we're talking about here, that's a little different. The bill requires school districts to keep using the AEAs for special education services, as is the current arrangement, but it puts a little split in the funding. By the second year, 90% of that funding has to go to the AEAs, but 10% can stay with the districts. And that's money that probably a lot of schools will end up putting toward special education in one way or another. But it's 10% that's less likely to go to the AEAs in the future. So people who are against this see that as a bit of a funding cut for the AEAs.
Right. Talk about the debate here. Democrats in the state house generally against this. I saw you quoting in your reporting the House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights saying there was more wrong with this bill than there was right with this bill, and Senate Democrats were right to vote against it.
Yeah, basically from the beginning, Democrats have questioned the whole premise that the governor raised when she brought up this issue. She described the AEAs as a system that's overfunded for the work they do and underperforming when you look at the performance of special education students on standardized tests. That premise came under a lot of question. You know, is it appropriate to use these standardized tests as the basis for major reforms to the AEA system? And then there were just major concerns from parents of students with disabilities. They rely on this AEA system for so much when it comes to the services that their children require in school and out of school, and really have a lot on the line when it comes to keeping that intact. So they were responding to those concerns as well. And what Democrats called for was to back off and just do a task force to study the system further and look at how the AEAs are really doing when it comes to student outcomes and make some new recommendations based on that report. That is part of this bill that passed. There will be a task force. It will make recommendations by the end of the year, but there are definitely changes that will be coming in the meantime before that task force has done its work. So Democrats voted against this in the House and Senate, even though it does contain some things they like when it comes to the teacher pay part of it.
Yeah, talk about that, because those are popular measures in both parties, right? What are they?
They are. And when this came up separately in the House at one point and was almost unanimous, but in the end, it was tucked into this bill that includes the changes to the AEAs. And what it would do is raise the minimum salary that schools can pay teachers. There's a floor in state law that was at $33,500. That was the minimum salary. That's going to go up in two steps next year and the year after that. And so first it will go up to $47,500, and then in the second year, $50,000. That will be the new minimum pay for you would see new teachers receive that salary. It also includes some other things that Governor Reynolds was asking for. One is a minimum for not only new teachers, but also veteran teachers who have been on the job for 12 years or more. There would be a minimum of $60,000 the first year, and then $62,000 would be the minimum for those teachers. And then something that the House added in, which is $14 million to school districts, spread across school districts, that would support increasing salaries for all the support staff in schools, and especially paraeducators. They came up a lot because they work directly with students with disabilities and have an important role to play when it comes to special education in schools. So schools are expected to use this to help help give raises to those workers who are they're paid an hourly wage.
If you've just joined us, IPR's education reporter, Grant Gerlach. In the few minutes we have remaining, Grant, talk about school funding levels, because the levels at which they are set, that's been delayed, and that puts school districts in a bit of a bind?
Yeah, so the legislature is supposed to decide by early February what the school funding levels will be for the next year. That is finally part of this AEA bill, so it was approved this week, but that's, you know, late March instead of early February. So schools will get a 2.5, well, the state is approving a 2.5% increase for K-12 schools. That adds around $119 million to state aid for public schools across the state. But because it's coming late, that's really compressed the timeline for schools to make a lot of decisions. They've been making all these contingency plans in the meantime. But now school districts have to finish preparing their budgets and put them through public comment. They can finalize the property tax rate for next year, which they've been sort of guessing on to this point because they want it to be as accurate as possible for what they actually need. And then they have to work out contracts with teachers and the teachers' unions. That's been on delay because this final number hasn't been there until now. So that's put off talks about what their pay rates will be, what the schedule will look like. And that's put off decisions by teachers of whether they're going to stay with the district or not, or and which positions schools will need to fill. So schools are able to make those final decisions now. But we already know that in some districts, they're looking at some deep cuts in some places. We know from coverage with the Des Moines Register and Cedar Rapids Gazette that Lynn Mar is looking at cutting dozens of teaching and staff positions. Des Moines still has a $9 million budget gap to close. Iowa City is closing an elementary, and they say part of the reason is that state funding isn't keeping up with rising costs. So funding is going up at the state level, but we're still seeing cuts happening at the district level when they line up the numbers.
And finally, Grant, Governor Reynolds' nominee to lead Iowa's education department, Mackenzie Snow, facing criticism as she goes through a confirmation process. She was hired last summer. What's been happening in that confirmation process?
Well, her confirmation went through a subcommittee this week, which is pretty unusual. Nominees don't normally go before a subcommittee. And this one lasted an hour with comments from supporters and critics and questions from the committee members. But Snow's nomination has drawn criticism from Democrats and some in education because she doesn't have a background working in schools as a teacher or a principal. Her background is largely in education policy, and she worked in the U.S. Department of Education under Betsy DeVos, who is a polarizing figure because she's a school choice and voucher proponent. But she has held administrative positions in other states. She worked as a division head in New Hampshire in their education agency and a deputy director of the education department in Virginia. And now she's here in Iowa. So critics really point out that she hasn't had this classroom experience, which they say will be especially important with the changes coming to the AEAs that we talked about. And part of that is the department will have more authority overseeing the work of those AEAs. They say the person in charge should have experience in special education. But she was defended by some other high-profile education leaders, like the superintendent of Des Moines Schools, the state's largest district, the president of the Des Moines Area Community College, the dean of the University of Iowa College of Education, and they say they've been impressed with Snow so far. Ultimately, her nomination is headed to the Senate, and she'll require a two-thirds vote to be confirmed in that job.
Grant Gerlach, IPR's education reporter. Thanks for the update, Grant.
You're welcome, Ben.
Plenty to come. It's your NewsBuzz edition of River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Mearden, Supel, and Downer, attorneys at law, dedicated to providing comprehensive legal solutions for Eastern Iowa since 1948. Located in downtown Iowa City and at MeardenLaw.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's your Friday NewsBuzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this 29th day of March. Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand says he has concerns over the review of emergency contraception by the Iowa Attorney General. Let's find out more from IPR healthcare reporter Natalie Krebs. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Ben.
Remind us, first of all, what this emergency contraception is.
So this was a policy that was put in place by Attorney General Brenna Byrd when she took office in last January. She basically decided to pause reimbursements for emergency contraception for rape victims. So when, you know, someone's been sexually assaulted and they get a rape kit, you know, things like medications for STIs and Plan B, basically emergency contraception, get reimbursed. This is under the Crime Victims Compensation Program is where the money comes from. It's a fund that's made up of the fines that people pay when they're convicted of something. So criminal fines and fees, it's not taxpayer dollars. Attorney General Byrd decided, you know, last January to put the program on pause while she said it was, you know, under review. And it's basically been on pause ever since. I think there's still the Attorney General's office is still accepting reimbursement requests, but they're not actually issuing reimbursements currently for emergency contraception.
What concerns did State Auditor Rob Sand voice this week then?
Yeah, so it's been over a year since Brenna Byrd put this policy on pause. And then, you know, from the Des Moines Register had reported, you know, that the Attorney General's office had told them through a public information request that the audit, the review that they are having for this particular policy is, it's still ongoing. It's not ready for release. That sort of prompted State Auditor Rob Sand to throw a press conference where he basically said he was concerned about the amount of time it was taken to review this policy. He also stated it was sort of unclear to him why they were reviewing this policy, you know, noting that he wasn't really sure what about it kind of triggered an audit. It's not particularly a service that costs a lot of money or, you know, is really a red flag area. And then also just kind of the use of the word audit, you know, he was just unclear as to kind of was saying he was unclear as to what the Attorney General's office really has been doing or what they're doing.
Right. And he pointed out in that press conference, didn't he? Very clearly, if you don't see it in his title, he is the state auditor. And what did he say? He hasn't been asked to audit this at all.
Right. He said that as well. You know, he hasn't been asked to audit it as well. And then just again, the Attorney General's office has continued to use the word audit when they're describing what's going on with the program and the review they're doing. And he just had a press conference to basically reiterate he wasn't really sure what they mean by audit and kind of what they're doing with their review.
Yeah. How did the Iowa Attorney General's office respond to what the state auditor had to say?
Yeah, I mean, the Attorney General Byrd's office basically responded accusing Rob Sand of, you know, making a political play on this. You know, Attorney General Brenna Byrd is a Republican. State Auditor Sand is a Democrat. They basically just, you know, accused him of trying to get attention and make a political move by pointing this out. And they said that they're still working on the review. It's really close to being ready for release. And just kind of dismissed his concerns as politics.
Yeah. What do rape victim advocates say about what's happening?
Yeah, Planned Parenthood has spoken out against it, saying, you know, it's a terrible policy to put on pause, basically, because you're having, you know, sexual assault victims aren't able to get this reimbursement for, you know, emergency contraception. I think a lot of kind of rape advocates, people who work with rape survivors, have been very concerned about kind of people's access to getting this kind of support, you know, from this program that has been kind of just there for a long time.
Yeah. Any word from the Attorney General's office, any timeline when this review, this audit will be done?
No exact timeline. Again, just this week, you know, they had said it's still kind of in its final stages. You know, they're saying they need senior officials to kind of, quote, sign off on it. They're saying very soon, but no kind of specific day or time or timeline yet on kind of when we're going to get this audit. And like for the last year or so, kind of the future of this particular policy has kind of just been up in the air.
IPR healthcare reporter Natalie Krebs, thank you for the update.
Thank you, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, remember earlier this month, we discussed here on River to River that announcement by Tyson Foods that it will shutter its pork plant in the central Iowa community of Perry. What a blow for that community. It's a pork plant that employs 1,300. More layoffs in the news this week, these announced by John Deere. Let's check in with Kevin Baskins, the Metro Jobs reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how are you?
Tell us about the layoffs announced at Deere. This is in Waterloo, right?
Yes. They announced this week that they'll be cutting 308 workers from its maintenance and production staff. Waterloo employs about 5,500 in their production and maintenance staff, 5,500 total and 3,600 in their production and maintenance staff. So you're kind of close to about 10% there.
Mm-hmm. And this follows an announcement earlier this month of workers laid off at Deere in another part of Iowa.
Yeah, the Des Moines plant that's located in Ankeny announced layoffs of 150 earlier this month. They have about 1,100 production and maintenance workers and a total of 1,700 employed at that facility.
What reason did the John Deere management give for these layoffs?
Kind of the standard one that they have to look at their business model from time to time and make adjustments. I think what we're seeing here is the net sales are down about 4% in the most recent quarter. Their earnings were down about 8% from a year ago. What we saw is that during the pandemic, when big companies like John Deere had supply issues, their production kind of fell down and it built some demand. In 22 and 23, they're anticipating drop in orders from record levels that they occurred in 22 and 23. So now it's probably kind of leveling off for them in terms of demand. You go back to 2021, and we actually documented that at the time, as John Deere's supply issues were kind of leveling out and they were able to ramp up production, John Deere in 21 was actually having a hard time even finding enough workers. So I think they've gotten to that point where they've gotten back up to production levels, and now they kind of have to level off to reflect the demand that there is in the market.
Kevin, as you noted in your reporting, this drew a quick response, these latest layoffs by Deere, a quick response from Democratic state lawmakers. Tell us about that.
Well, the two lawmakers that weighed in right away, of course, were the ones from Waterloo and Cedar Falls, because obviously there's an immediate impact on their community anytime you have jobs, certainly the caliber of John Deere, that get lost. But the Democrats have had a number of concerns really going all the way back to 2017, when the state laws regarding unions were kind of changed. Iowa has always been a right to work and that a right to work state. So there's always been concerns about the Democrats in terms of union participation. But the concerns the Democrats had were some changes that have been made in unemployment law that cut back the number of months that laid off workers eligible for unemployment benefits. That was their primary concern that they voiced when these layoffs were announced.
Right. And I think the quote you have there, the Democrats saying this law change by Republicans in 2022 eliminated two full months of unemployment benefits for these laid off workers.
Yes, it did. What is kind of ironic is that at the time that occurred, the primary concern was actually construction workers. Because unionized construction workers, a lot of times, are laid off for extended periods of time during the winter months, just simply because they can't work due to weather conditions. What's kind of interesting is that, we've had a mild winter, so that really hasn't had the impact that we've seen in the past. But construction jobs in Iowa are also at an all-time high. When you look at Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers that have been recorded since 1990, the number of construction jobs in Iowa have never been higher.
Interesting. So Kevin, I mentioned the layoffs in Perry, actually the shutting down of the pork plant in Perry, these latest John Deere layoffs. But put this in the context of other layoffs you've been watching.
Well, one of the things that happens when you have a big company like John Deere or Tyson do layoffs is sometimes it kind of has a trickle-down effect. For example, yesterday it was announced that PSSI, that does the sanitation work for the Tyson plant in Perry, will be laying off 76 workers in June, coinciding with the closing of that plant. The other one that we have seen kind of a lot of activity in has been Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo in Des Moines has had 262 layoffs in the last year and 1,300 since 2018. And that kind of reflects, you know, once again, something that's happening nationally, and that's interest rates that correspond to the number of mortgages made. And a lot of the people in Des Moines with Wells Fargo work in the mortgage industry. And so we've seen, you know, a pretty sizable shift in workforce here in Des Moines from Wells Fargo, which up until a year ago was the leading employer in the Des Moines metro area. And because some of these cuts, they're no longer the leading employer in this area.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, very quickly, on a lighter note, let's talk about a new contest in Iowa sponsored by the Iowa Association of Business and Industry and Midwest One Bank called The Coolest Thing Made in Iowa, since we're talking about things made in Iowa.
Yeah, it's the first year that Iowa has offered this contest, although it's been offered in other states around the country. And it's been kind of interesting when you look at those other states. Winning products have ranged everywhere from F-18 fighter jets in South Carolina to kind of the absorbent material made in Arkansas that goes into things like diapers. So even here, as you look in Iowa, things that are manufactured, I mean, people are going to look at everything probably from Wells Fargo or from Wells Blue Bunny ice cream to giant John Deere tractors and Winnebagos and Indian motorcycles. So I think Iowans are going to have a wide diversity of products to select from. And I think what you'll also see too is Iowans will probably have some pretty strong loyalties to products that are made in their own areas. So it will be interesting to watch this as it progresses.
Yeah, and Iowans can weigh in?
Yes, Iowans can weigh in. Go to the Association of Business and Industry webpage, and there'll be a link there that will take you to the voting. Right now, they're in the nominating process until early April, where people can nominate products. And then it'll look very much like a March Madness type bracket after that. It'll start with a Sweet 16. Iowans will weigh in on those 16 products, narrowing it to 8 and then to 4, and then eventually to a winner that will be crowned at the ABI conference in June.
Okay. Kevin Baskins, Metro jobs reporter with the Des Moines Register, telling us there at the end about a new contest, The Coolest Things Made in Iowa, sponsored by the Iowa Association of Business Industry and Midwest One Bank. Kevin, thanks for the update. Bye now.
Yep, thank you.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, did you find you had a muddy windshield earlier this week? If so, it's probably thanks to an oddity in our weather. Joined now by Justin Glisson, State Climatologist of Iowa with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Thanks for making time for us again, Justin.
Hi, Ben. Always nice to be with you.
Iowans experienced an unusual weather phenomenon. This was Monday, muddy rain. What happened?
Yes, yeah, so it's an interesting phenomenon. In fact, my colleague, Dr. Dave Dubois, who's the State Climatologist of New Mexico, reached out on Twitter and sent me a message saying, sending some of our soil to at Justin M. Glisson in Iowa. So we have drought conditions in New Mexico and Texas. With these drought conditions, very dry soils, those soils were able to be lofted by very strong winds into the upper atmosphere. And then it co-located with that strong low pressure center that was coming through on Sunday into Monday. And the two mixed together, the rain actually took hold of those dust particles, created that muddy rain, and it fell. And it fell gently across much of the state. gentle enough where it doesn't wash away. So as that water evaporates through the day and overnight into the morning hours, we still see that mud on our vehicles and in anything else that it's visible on.
Yeah. Kind of scary. Echoes of the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, Justin.
Yes. I mean, we've had several events over the last few years. In fact, the December 15th, 2021 serial derecho actually also brought in large amounts of dust and even smoke from wildfires in Kansas, that along with those 63 tornadoes that we saw. So as we're mixing more particulate in the atmosphere, we can even get this with wildfire smoke interacting with raindrops. We get a lot more particulate and dust and pollution at the surface when it's brought down by precipitation events.
Mm-hmm. Justin, if our listeners are experiencing some early spring allergy symptoms, they're worse this year because of the weather and our weird winter, right?
Very weird winter, the second warmest on record. December was the third warmest. February was the warmest and second driest. So we had all of the conditions necessary for enhanced phenology. And phenology is when we expect green up. So we're anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks ahead of schedule. Given the very warm conditions that we've seen in February, we're about 4 degrees warmer in March than normal. So you combine that with the CO2 that's available in the atmosphere, given that we're starting to green up. Enhances that CO2 feedback into the photosynthetic processes that our plants go through to create oxygen, but they also create more blooms earlier in the season, more pollen, and a longer pollen season, and hence enhanced allergies.
Okay, so because it starts earlier doesn't mean it will end earlier, it just gets longer.
In fact, yes, if you look at the trends, our growing season has expanded anywhere from 10 to 15 days. So we can expect, given that our our frosts and falls are getting deeper into fall and our spring thaws are becoming earlier, we're stretching out that growing season and enhancing our allergy season as well.
Justin, we are in or entering the typical severe weather season in the spring here in the Midwest. I wonder, has that timeline of seasonal severe weather been affected by the unusual winter and the changing climate?
Yes, definitely. With a changing climate, we've seen winter as the fastest warming season. So we've started to see severe weather events push into the colder time of the year, particularly late fall into early winter, as I mentioned, the December 15th event. But we've also had some severe weather events across the South. And these are we're seeing an enhancement of severe weather across the South in that tornado alley that we call Dixie Alley. But also with a warmer atmosphere, more water vapor, we're enhancing instability, and with more instability, we're more apt to have thunderstorms. And you look at the particularly warm February into March, and the outlooks are suggesting a warmer and wetter pattern as we get into April. That's the type of fuel in the large-scale configuration that we have thunderstorms forming. Not necessarily severe, but thunderstorms are more prone to occur in that type of atmosphere.
Always enjoy having our state climatologist of Iowa, Justin Glisson, join us. Thank you, Justin. Have a wonderful Easter weekend.
You do the same, Ben. Always a pleasure to be with you.
We'll be back after a short break with more of our NewsBuzz edition of River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's your NewsBuzz edition of River to River. From IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer.
Here to see the featured attraction, it's Caitlin Clark.
She is the biggest brand in college sports.
Caitlin Clark media has reached an unprecedented fervor. We all know about the reigning National Player of the Year's exploits on the court, but her off-the-court impact is like something we've never seen. I'm Jeff Ullman, a professor of business analytics at the University of Iowa. Welcome to Clarkonomics 101.
Indeed. Welcome to Clarkonomics 101. Let's step into Jeff Ullman's classroom for a look at Caitlin Clark's incredible impact on women's basketball off the court, her economic impact. Joining me in the studio, University of Iowa Professor of Business Analytics, Jeff Ullman. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Did that video make quite a splash? It was on ESPN. They came to you for this?
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to be on their radar. I've done some sports analytics research, and just like everybody else, I'm riding on Caitlin Clark's coattails here.
We just heard the very short start of it. It's an entertaining, what, two-minute video, informative. You call it Clarkonomics 101. Before we dig into the data that you have on this video in some depth, you use the phrase Taylor Swift-like attraction of Caitlin Clark. What do you mean by that?
Well, just like Taylor Swift... It's not just, you know, girls and the everyday, you know, music fan, or, you know, it's everybody knows about Caitlin Clark. I mean, I have an 8-year-old son, and he doesn't really follow sports that much, you know, yet. I kind of am hoping he does, but he knows one athlete, Caitlin Clark.
Does he have a jersey?
Not yet, but I'm sure he'll be asking for one.
Number 22. Let's go through some of the data more in depth that you touched on in that video very quickly. Attendance. Attendance at Carver Hawkeye Arena. And very cleverly, you say BC, which means?
Before Caitlin.
Before Caitlin. And after Caitlin. Tell us about that.
So I looked at a few years before Caitlin arrived, in about 2010 on, and there was an upward increase in attendance for women's basketball. I mean, Iowa has a longstanding support of women's sports. But before Caitlin, that average was like around 5,000 for a women's basketball game. And now the entire arena has been sold out. It's like, and that's 15,000. So she's nearly tripled the attendance for home games. But also she sold out every road game. And that's like the Taylor Swift attraction. I mean, it's not just Iowa fans here in Iowa that love Caitlin Clark. She sells out every game she's at.
So she goes to arenas where they're not used to those numbers, and they just fill up, and Caitlin Clark is coming to town. So they're like, wow, this is big business.
Yeah. So she, like I said, nearly tripled the attendance of games versus pre-Caitlin era, both home and away.
You have some staggering data on how expensive some of these tickets have become.
Oh, yes. It's I would say if you just look at the average, like the average ticket before Caitlin was about only $29, and now it's on average over $129. So almost $100 increase average.
Right, but that's even if you can get them, right?
Yes. if you look at the most extreme case was the season finale against Ohio State, where the average secondary market price was over $400.
Mm-hmm. In your ESPN video, you also use the phrase, like Beyonce, Caitlin is showing girls run the world. Explain that one.
Well, again, for the longest time, I mean, we think about Be Like Mike, and people talk about the ruthless competitors and all these attributes that were associated with men's sports. You talk about the NCAA tournament, people immediately think about, oh, it's the men's tournament. Well, you can't do that anymore, because
you could ask me who's playing in the men's tournament. I don't think I could answer that. Maybe that shouldn't be on the air, but it's the truth.
And so now we're actually having to make that realization, like, wait a minute, we talk about the NCAA tournament, you want to talk about the men's or the women's,
right?
Because it's not clear without making that differentiation. And so, you know, over half the population is women, and they're voicing their interests.
Right. And aside from business, you think about the young people, I guess primarily girls, but as you mentioned, your son, boys, young people totally inspired by this young woman growing up in Iowa.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's not just women. So I would not call Caitlin Clark an amazing women's basketball player. I'd call her an amazing generational talent.
Exactly.
Period. And so, just an example, I went to a men's basketball game here at Iowa, and was with my daughter and one of her friends. And he turned to me, he's like, these aren't as exciting as the women's game. Nothing against it, nothing against the men's games, but that just tells you, I mean, you would have never even fathomed a comment like that from a 14-year-old boy, you know, years ago.
You talked about attendance. What about those who can't make it in person to the games? Viewership, what has it done there?
The last year's national championship game was 9.9 million eyeballs, which was almost double the most watched NCAA basketball game for women's before that. And so, you know, people are dialing into these games.
Mm-hmm. What about the economic impact on the University of Iowa, the state of Iowa?
Well, so those economic numbers are, there's been some studies that have cited those anywhere between like, you know, 14 million to 52 million. There's so much lag in like the merchandise sales and in restaurants and all, you know, clicks and all these things that I haven't been able to, you know, peg those down. So, you know, I haven't looked into them.
Yeah,
right?
It will be kind of hard to name.
Right. But if you just want to think about this, if she's increased the attendance of each home game by, say, let's say 10,000 people from 5,000 to 15,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the average sold price of that ticket has increased, say, roughly $100. That's $1 million right there.
Mm.
That's for every home game. You know, you have 14 home games this year. Where, you know, again, this is back of the envelope hand waving math, but you're talking about $14 million without even like thinking about anything else but just ticket price, right?
And you've heard as well as I have the distances people will go to drive to see Caitlin Clark.
Oh, absolutely. You're talking like 300, 400 miles. People who like have signs up, and then the average number, if you look at zip code data from secondary ticket sellers, you'll easily see an average travel distance of hundreds of miles.
Mm-hmm. I guess a big question going forward, how lasting are the changes she has brought to basketball? I didn't say women's basketball. I said basketball.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. I mean, from her perspective, it's going to be interesting. She moves on to the WNBA and she's going to have to sustain that success, but is also is like that, you know, is that fervor and that tension going to move with her, and how much of it's going to stay in women's college basketball? Because there's amazing athletes in women's college basketball. And I'm the opinion that people are just going to recognize that. And they're like, hey, we're not going to stop watching this now because Caitlin's moved on, but we're going to, you know, watch the next generation of great women.
How did you, I take it, Clarkonomics is not your main gig at the Tippy College of Business. How did you get on to Clarkonomics? Did you coin that, by the way?
I think you'll see Clarkonomics has been used by several other people. I'm not going to say that I came up with it. When ESPN reached out to me, they're like, hey, we're interested in this off-the-court economic impact. And then they kind of like labeled that. That was kind of like the internal code name for mm-hmm. it. And I'm just like, I'm willing to do whatever you want. You know, just, you know, let me, you know, put together a story and see if you like it.
Yeah. What about an endowed Clarkonomics chair at the Tippy College of Business?
We'll work on that.
Can you give us an idea of how many others, be it in economics or other fields, are studying her impact in other ways? Any sense of that?
I mean, there's the field of sports analytics, not necessarily economic related, has been quite growing. I mean, this is something that's like I've been involved with for 20 years.
And what does that mean exactly, sports analytics?
I would say this is the application of math and data to sports problems and sports data. And so these are the type of things I've done work looking at, like television viewership, primetime television viewership of NFL games, the dynamics of player selection in, say, the NFL or NBA mm-hmm. draft. And so this sort of thing with Caitlin Clark came up where they were talking about, like, look, this is such a dramatic impact. And I was just like, oh, I can take a look at some of the data and give you an idea of, like, what does this really mean? And then actually coming up with interesting ways to visualize that data is what I really was focusing on.
Yeah. Saturday, the women Hawkeyes are playing, what, Colorado, right, in the Sweet 16?
That's correct.
What are your thoughts about that game?
Well, I think everybody would love to see a rematch between Iowa and LSU.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think that would be like the what everybody wants. That's what all the television people want. That's what fans would like. But both teams have an amazingly hard matchups before that. Iowa has to play Colorado. Colorado beat LSU earlier this year, so they are a team that, you know, I'm sure they watched the tape of the West Virginia game, and they're going to try to basically apply that, except, you know, do better. And LSU has to beat UCLA, who's the number two seed. So there's, I would say, like a 25% chance maybe of the Iowa-LSU matchup happening, because I think every one of those games is a coin flip.
What are your thoughts about the men in the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, it's not very often where the men's NCAA tournament feels like it's playing second fiddle to the women's. But as you mentioned, there's a lot of attention on the women's tournament, which is awesome. But also, now, as like a longtime sports fan, this is like the 32nd anniversary of Christian Laettner's shot against Kentucky. And so Duke plays Houston as well in the Sweet 16. So that's a game that people will be using that type of narrative to talk about. Houston's got an amazing defense, and so I would like to see maybe a new blood to come in, but they're going to be battling against a blue blood. Mm-hmm. And another story again in the NCAA tournament that I particularly am attuned to is Purdue. I mean, Purdue annually has a great team, and then perhaps getting a lot of criticism because they sometimes not perform as well in March. But they're playing to get into a Final Four for the first time in 44 years. And so they played extremely well in the first two rounds. And so I joke, maybe they got themselves a good sports psychologist now.
How did this video get made with ESPN? Did they approach you?
Yeah, they reached out to me. They're just like, oh, we'd like an Iowa flavor to Caitlin. And we want to talk about a lot of things that she's doing that is like, you know, off the court impact. And they're like, notice I have done some sports analytics work, and they're just interested in if I could put some together. And I'm like, well, this is actually something I would quite enjoy.
Yeah. And so you wrote it and they did the production?
Yeah, I storyboarded it, and then they did the magic to make every, you know, animated my crayons, my Crayola drawings, and they animated it. And then they said, all right, here's the, you know, you want to come up with a script, a voice over it? And I'd be happy to.
Okay. Well, it's an entertaining video. Lots of information there in a very compact form. University of Iowa Professor of Business Analytics, Jeff Ullman, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
And that just about does it for this News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News on this last Friday of March, March the 28th, 2024. I'm joined now by Cece Mitchell of IPR Studio One to groove us into the weekend. So nice to have you with me, Cece, to end this program.
Yep, I'm glad to be here.
What do you have for us to start off?
So the first track I have to share with you today, it's by Adrienne Lenker. So she's best known for being the lead singer for the band Big Thief. We play them quite a bit on tracks, but she's also pretty accomplished as a solo musician as well. So she just released a new album. It's called Bright Future. And the song I have to share with you today is a single from that record. It's called Free Treasure.
Do you wanna go to the river and all these spots so deep and green? With wild raspberries and apple trees and rocks to climb between. Water like a washing machine. Do you wanna dance? Sometimes I think I try too hard. I trip on my shoes and I trip on my shirt. Get caught on the dirt in the yard. Caught on the dirt in the yard, you show me understanding, patience and pleasure, time and attention, love without measure, love without measure. You're cooking dinner, it's getting around half past ten. I haven't smelled food so good since I don't know. Kitchen floor. Just when I thought I couldn't feel more, I feel a little more. I feel a little understanding, patience and pleasure, time and attention, love without measure, love without measure.
New music by Adrienne Lenker there, Free Treasure. Love that tune and those lyrics as well. CC, we have time for one more.
Sure thing. So the next track I've got is a single. It went viral. It's from an artist we play on tracks quite a bit called Hozier. We'll be seeing Hozier at this summer's Hinterland Festival again. And if you're a TikTok fan, you'll probably recognize this track because it is quite catchy. The track is Too Sweet by Hozier.
Thank you.
That is catchy, to put it mildly. We'll go out with Hozier, the Irish musician, singer, and songwriter. CC, thanks for a couple of nice choices, and remind us how we can listen to our daily soundtrack.
Your daily soundtrack, it's every night at 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. here on IPR. We've also got all access from 1 to 4 p.m. on Saturdays.
CC Mitchell, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ben.
Grooving us into the weekend, CC Mitchell. Today's program produced by Danny Gear. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Ben Kiefer. Until next week.